So in that group, we had this dramatic improvement in quality of life, dramatic reduction in fatigue, reduction in anxiety and depression, improvement in verbal reasoning, nonverbal reasoning, and half of our folks had clinically meaningful improvement in gait.
Hey guys, and welcome. You're listening to The Reslier Way with Jacob Gordon. I'm your host, Jacob, and I'm so excited to have you here today. In today's episode, we have Dr. Terry Walls, a leading researcher in multiple sclerosis. Not only has she suffered from MS herself, but she has also figured out how to improve MS and improve it for her patients. In my interview with her and Dr. Craig Tanio, we discuss her research with the VA, universities, and trying to get FDA approval. Her latest book, The Walls Diet, Why 21st Century Medicine Hasn't Caught On Yet, Root Causes and Stressors Relating to MS, as well as Resiliency Factors. So without further ado, let's get started. Thank you, Dr. Walls, for coming on the show today.
Hey, you're welcome. Glad to be here.
I'm excited to have you here. Your story is absolutely fascinating, from being an athlete and dwindling down to fatigue to your whole recovery. I'd love to hear more about that. Would you be able to tell me a little bit about your story?
So yeah, before I entered medical school, I competed in full contact free sparring, actually in the Pan American trials. So I was absolutely a very big time athlete, entered medical school, started having some zingers in my elliptical face pain. That would become progressively more troublesome. Then in 2000, my wife noticed while I was out walking, my left leg's not working right. I agreed to go see a neurologist. He says, you know, this could be bad or really, really bad. Being a physician, I know I'm looking at either ALS or MS, and I prefer an early death to lingering disability. So secretly, I'm praying for ALS. But what I have is MS. And it takes only 3 years, and I'm needing to get a tilt-reclined wheelchair. I get my tisantrin infusions that will help. Then I try Tysabri infusion. That doesn't help. Then I am too weak to sit up at my desk. But fortunately, I can still read. I can still think. So I'm studying the basic science night after night. And I begin to experiment on myself. And, you know, the speed of my decline slows. And I am so grateful. But I'm still declining. My zingers are more frequent, more severe, more really awful. My daughter, you know, who's just 10, puts her arms around me trying to comfort me. But her touch triggers more pain, more zingers, you know, and so I'm gritting my teeth as well to try and not scream as my family is touching me. The university redesigns my job so I can continue to work. They assign me to review clinical trials for safety, and I get better at reading the science. But, you know, I have a progressive disease, and I've had 4 years in the wheelchair, unable to sit up, so I've learned to let go of my future, and I'm taking each day as it unfolds. I review a research protocol that uses electrical stimulation muscles. I ask my physical therapist, you know, hey, could I try that? And he says, you know, Terry, this is for athletes. It's really painful. And I tell him, no, I'm an athlete. I competed in full contact free sparring and taekwondo at the Pan American trials. I can do this. And he lets me. He hooks me up, dials up the current. It does really hurt a lot. But when I'm done, you know, I feel great thanks to all those endorphins. So I begin doing E-stim to as much pain as I can tolerate. I decide to add in daily meditation. I go back to my paleo diet, and I redesign that based on all the science I've been studying.
For the E-stim that you're doing, what type of waves were it?
Well, it would depend. If I was doing small muscles, it was an asymmetric wave. If it was large muscles, then it was a square wave that was symmetric. And again, depending on small muscles or large muscles, it would have to do with the number of hertz that I would use at that time. And let me tell you, I was doing this to as much pain as I could tolerate, multiple times a day, and eventually I would figure out how to take my portable device with me to work. And so I was stimming many, many hours each day. And what's remarkable is just 1 month into this, I can sit up again at my desk.
And 1 month with the E-stim and the paleo diet?
Well, I've been doing the paleo diet for about 5 years. It wasn't until I redesigned my paleo diet, you know, based on the science, and I'm doing the E-Stim, I'm back to meditation. 1 month into all of that, I can sit up again. Big deal.
Wow.
Huge deal.
Yeah.
3 months into that, those zingers that I've been having 27 years are gone. 5 months into this, I can stand and I walk down the halls at the hospital, stunning everyone. And 9 months into this, I convinced my family that I want a bike. And so we have this emergency family meeting. My wife says, okay, we all get into position. My son's going to run on the left. My daughter's going to run the side on the right. My wife's going to follow on her bike. You know, and she gives a signal. I push off. The bike wobbles, but I catch my balance, and I bike around the block. My son's crying. My wife's crying. I'm crying. If you could see me now, I still cry talking about this because that was such a miraculous day. Because remember, I had let go of my future. And even though I had remarkably improved, that you know, able to walk around, I didn't know what any of that stuff meant. I was just taking each day as it unfolded. But once I biked around the block, I understood that the current understanding of MS was incomplete.
That's beautiful.
Who knew how much recovery might be possible? And 5 months after that bike around the block, my wife sees the Courage Ride, which is an 18.5-mile ride, says, let's sign you up. And at that point, I'd gotten so I could ride my bike 8 miles. So this is going to be a big jump.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, my family's with me. And as I cross that finish line, and once again, everybody's crying. My kids are crying. My wife's crying. I'm crying. And of course, now I really am quite tired by this, but like, oh my God, so triumphant. And this, of course, really transforms how I think about disease and health. And it transforms the way I practice medicine. Because now I'm talking to my patients about their diet, what they're eating.
So by this time, you knew you were onto something. Something.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I'm onto something miraculous. I'm onto something spectacular. How I'm thinking about disease and health has really been transformed. I'm talking more and more to my patients about, you know, what are they eating? What are they doing? And because, you know, I've transformed my approach to food, I'm really very comfortable talking to people about food and their choices. And the residents in the clinic are so stunned to see how effective I am at convincing these crusty vets to make big changes in their eating patterns and to make big changes in their daily habits, which lead then to steady improvements in blood pressure and blood sugar. We're having to reduce medications and take people off medications.
Terry, what kind of approaches were you doing with the vets that made it that much more effective, let's say, compared to, you know, what a conventional physician might do?
You know, I'm asking them what they're eating, what they're doing, and I'm using metaphors that matter to them. So my farmers get that you can't get a champion steer feeding them junk.
Mm.
My mechanics get that you can't pour sugar into the gas line and expect the motor to work well. My teachers understand that the student who stays up all night doing alcohol and drugs is not going to perform well on their test. So I have to have metaphors that matter, engage them to try. And the other thing that I learned that's really effective, say, you know, let's do this as an experiment. When you're ready, do this. And I'd encourage 100 days, but if they could go at least 2 weeks, that would be enough to see the change. So you empower the vet that they're the ones to make the choice and decide when they're going to do it. And the other questions I'd we'd ask a lot about what do they want their health for? Another big question was, is there something or someone you care so deeply about that if they were in a burning house, without even thinking, you would run in to go save them? Once we got that identified, then we could begin the journey of what they could do that's under their control. You know, and I couldn't convince everyone. At first, you know, I was convincing half my vets to make big changes. And by the time I retired from the VA, I'd say easily I was getting 90% of the vets. to make these really big changes.
How long ago was that at the VA?
So I came to the university in the VA in 2000. I retired from the VA at the end of December of 2014. Mm-hmm. And I made that decision because, well, two things. I'm really committed to continuing the research that I do. So I was going to stay with the university. And I'm also committed to teaching the public what I do. I just had to spend more time supporting my mission of, creating my teaching programs for other physicians and my teaching programs for the public. My wife, understandably said, honey, you can't work all the time. You're going to have to cut hours either at the VA or the university. And she knew I wasn't going to cut hours from the university, so I've retired from the VA. And that worked out beautifully. We hired other team members to continue the clinic that I was running. So they're doing very well, and that clinic continues to grow. And the live events that I do for the public and the virtual events that I do for the public and clinicians have just dramatically grown in these last 4 years. So it's been a very good thing for everyone.
You've done a significant amount of research on this whole subject, through your whole experience and with patients as well. I'm curious how this evolved? Process like that all evolved because you don't see clinical trials with diets and lifestyle changes.
Correct. So, the first thing that happens, I had this personal transformation. I start telling the public. The local organic grocer, some local churches, the local MS chapter wanted me to come speak with them. I got interviewed, got banned by the MS Society because they thought my message was dangerous. I let it roll off my back. I do other speaking gigs, community colleges, regional meetings. I get a TED Talk that's has millions of views. I have a best-selling book. Then the MS Society comes back and unbanned, reverses their banning of me, has me come to their wellness conference. I'm part of that. I submit a grant to the MS Society, and they now fund me. They give me $1 million. And that was in the fall of 2016, which actually was why I retired from the VA so I could spend my time running that research study. In the meantime, in 2010, so I recovered in 2008, my chair of medicine gave me the job assignment of getting what's called the safety and feasibility trial going that would take the same protocol that I used for my recovery, write that up into a rigid protocol. We ran 20 other patients with progressive MS through that protocol. So that's called the single arm study. It was very exciting. We did very well. Published 4 papers out of that little study, ran 2 more, again, small pilot studies. Again, very positive results.
What were the results?
So we have them published from the first study of progressive MS. And keep in mind, those progressive MS, you expect to decline 10 to 20%. So in that group, we had this dramatic improvement in quality of life, dramatic reduction in fatigue, reduction in anxiety and depression, improvement in verbal reasoning, nonverbal reasoning, and half of our folks had clinically meaningful improvement in gait. But, limitations, that's a single-arm study. Mm-hmm. Then we do randomized studies. So the next randomized study was a comparison of the study diet to following your usual diet. And in that study, we again showed remarkable improvement in quality of life and reduction in fatigue. And we had a moderate improvement in walking. Of course, it's a much shorter study. That one was only 12 weeks. The next study, we compared a ketogenic diet, a paleo diet, my version of the paleo diet, to someone's usual diet. And what we found was the Walls diet was better than the keto diet, and both were better than the weightless control. So then we're doing our fourth study. That's the low-fat diet versus the Walls diet. That study's been completed. We've analyzed that data. And
is the low-fat diet the Swank diet?
Yes, it was the Swank diet versus Walls elimination diet. So that data has been analyzed. We've written it up, and it's under review for publication. I'm very hopeful that that will get, we'll find the right publisher, and we'll get all the reviewer comments, et cetera, taken care of, and hopefully it will get out in press in 2021. And now we're doing our fifth clinical trial. And in this trial, this is called quasi-experimental, so it's non-randomized. We're taking people who are newly diagnosed with either clinically isolated syndrome or newly diagnosed relapsing remitting MS, who've been offered disease-modifying drug therapy and have declined it because they want to use diet and lifestyle. And we're training them on this steady diet. We're teaching them a daily meditation and putting them on a walking program. They get a monthly group support call, and they can have unlimited text and email conversations with the dietitian. The control group is getting MS care from a MS neurologist, and they are taking disease-modifying drugs, and they can follow whatever dietary plan they and their medical team think is appropriate. It's a little disappointing. We had planned to be able to see them and get MRIs at baseline at the end, but because of the pandemic, we can't do that. We'll have to abstract the medical record to get to capture the results of the what was found in the clinical exam by their physicians and the MRI exam. Mm-hmm. We're very excited. We have 29 folks enrolled in the intervention arm. We're still enrolling in the control arm, and we will follow them for a year. So again, that will be a very, very exciting study.
What is the process, especially for these studies, to get FDA approved?
Well, so the FDA does not approve the study. The study is reviewed by what's called the Institutional Review Board. Mm-hmm. Each research organization has a review board that reviews the application for the research for safety. And if they have questions or concerns, they may tell the investigator, you have to make these changes in order for us to feel that this is going to be appropriate and safe. Then they review every year your progress. Typically, for a intervention study, there is a safety board and a medical safety officer that reviews adverse events to be sure that there's no serious harm or unexpected problems in that study. Mm-hmm. For all of our studies, we've had the University of Iowa Institutional Review Board review our studies and have safety monitoring boards to make sure everything is safe and appropriate.
In the documentary, I think at the end, there was a mention that there is a goal to try to get FDA approval of the protocol.
Well, yeah, so
separate than the research itself.
Yeah, so the goal is if you have two randomized controlled trials,
yeah,
then you can apply for FDA approval. That's a big expensive process. Mm-hmm. A randomized trial of this nature would probably be about $3 million. Mm-hmm. So you're talking $6 million in a FDA application to get that kind of approval. Absolutely, that is my goal. But we'll have to get more studies, and we'll need to get the NIH approval to be able to fund that kind of study.
And if you could kind of get that, or I should say not if, when you can get that, and let's say those are positive trials showing a difference, do you think that leads the way then to better insurance coverage, or what do you think would be the impact of that?
Well, it'll be first thing, if you get two randomized controlled trials showing the Walls diet or the low-fat saturated fat diet, mm-hmm. Is effective at improving quality of life or reducing fatigue, and I'm very confident that in those kinds of outcomes, then this becomes the standard of care for treating neurologists to say, you know what, diet really matters, that right. You absolutely should be following one of these two dietary plans. Once you have those two big randomized controlled trials, even if the FDA has not approved it, it becomes the standard of care. So, you know, sort of interesting. There's a special, a particular kind of application for an IND or an IEE that you have to go through to get approval for a drug intervention or a device intervention or dietary intervention. But keep in mind, like the diabetic diet or the American Heart Association diet, they never asked for FDA approval, but because they've been, there are studies showing that they've been effective, mm-hmm. they became the standard of care, and they ultimately became something that insurance companies and Medicare will cover because mm-hmm. they became the standard of care. So I'm incredibly optimistic. 10 years ago, I'm banned as a speaker, you know, because my ideas were so dangerous. But because of my persistence with doing that clinical research, publishing the data, you know, and then my skill at telling the story in the TED Talk and in my books, we've created this national interest, which led to more funding for other little pilot studies about dietary interventions. So now the study of MS, there are actually quite a few small little pilot studies about the impact of diet on many biomarkers and quality of life measures for MS. The MS Society created a working group on nutrition and invited me to be part of that working group. So I'm now in this group with a dozen other neurology and neuroscientists who investigate diet and who care a lot about diet quality for the MS patients. So yeah. we're changing practice. It's very exciting.
Oh, it really is. And I think what's so impressive is that there certainly have been a set of people who have gotten the public interested in changes in lifestyle and a functional and paleo approach. But there have been less people who have been really able to change the, let's call it the conventional medical practice. And medicine has always been a bit notorious for taking its time to incorporate new data. And I've just been so personally impressed how some of the local medical community and the practicing neurologists are starting to adapt. Just tell me, I'd be really interested in kind of your, you know, approach to changing the medical community, because I imagine that's not been an easy set of conversations.
Well, I can think about the process here at the University of the VA where I practiced. When I first made these big changes in how I practiced medicine, it made people very uncomfortable because mm-hmm. it was quite different. My chief of staff calls me in and he says, like, Terry, what's going on? You know, people are upset. They're complaining. I hear you're banned as a speaker. Now, I brought with me an armful of the scientific papers that underpinned my thinking in terms of what I was doing and why. I went through those papers with him and I won him over. And he said, you know, look, if there's ever an adverse outcome from one of Terry's patients, she'll go through peer review just like we would for anyone else. But in the meantime, her advice to eat more vegetables, meditate, and move more is what you should all be doing. There's nothing wrong with what she's saying. And then my chair of medicine, you know, likewise, I had to go meet with him over at the university, have the same kind of conversation. And his response was, this is so important, you're going to do clinical research, and I'll get you the mentors. So he was visionary. He said, shift the research, because I was in a different field of research. So we shifted my research focus into these early clinical trials. And he got me the mentors. Thanks to Paul Rothman, I went down this path of these very interesting clinical trials. Every year, the University and the VA have research week, so we're presenting our data and showing these GAIT videos with these amazing restorations of function. I start going around various departments at the University and the VA talking about my research, my data, these videos that are so, so striking. Our publications finally start getting into print. And as more of our studies get into print, that's helpful. And the other thing that's really helpful is my work is touching the lives of people. Mm-hmm. I have more and more people in the public. And I'm doing this radical thing of telling the public what I'm doing and why. And let me tell you, I got a lot of criticism for that, a huge amount of criticism for doing the research at the same time telling the public, eat more vegetables, meditate, go see a physical therapist and start exercising.
And what was the criticism? Was it false hope or was it
false hope? You should not be talking about this. You don't have published research data yet. This is wrong. I've worked very closely with unfortunately, the chair of medicine had seen my decline, my amazing recovery, had become the dean of medicine. I worked with my colleagues at the university to be very clear in my presentations, in my books that I was writing, in the lectures I'm giving that I'm disclosing. This is my personal experience. This is the science behind why I do what I do. And this is the science behind why I'm doing clinical trials the way I'm doing them. So I'm very, very, very transparent in all of that. And I'm also very public. I get this big following on my YouTube videos, you know, has 3.5 million views on that. My best-selling
is
book.
Is that your TED Talk?
Not TED Talk, yes.
TEDx Talk?
Okay. TEDx Talk. And then, you know, I have best-selling books. And then this next thing that happens, stunning, the university sets up a research account for me, which I'm using, raising a small amount of money to fund my very interesting small pilot studies. The university gets a cold call from somebody in Hong Kong who makes a six-figure donation into my research fund.
Oh, wow.
So that's a big deal. And that lets us do, you know, another one of our little pilot studies. And then the university gets a second cold call with another person who wants to do a six-figure donation. So I'm getting to do these very interesting pilot studies, which is how, you know, those first three studies all got funded, completely by philanthropic efforts. Then I get a meeting on my schedule with the dean. We have a new dean now, a dean of the medical school, who wants me to come explain what's going on with my lab, my research, my public persona, invisibility, because now the university's really impressed because they've never had anyone get the kind of philanthropic support without a lot of support from the university foundation getting all of that to happen. And so it was the passion I have for the mission, the remarkable success that I have, and the fact I've touched the lives of so many people around the globe, which led to this remarkable philanthropic support, which then allows me to do this very innovative research. So then you get the preliminary data to write these grants, which led to the larger grant with the MS Society. And we're using that data to write for grants back to the NIH.
And where do you think this criticism of false hope comes from? Because, you know, if I just kind of break that down in terms of food, people need to eat food, so it's not like a pharmaceutical where you're saying, oh, well, you don't have to take a pharmaceutical. It's like, do you eat healthy food or unhealthy food?
I was putting out the message to refuse drugs, do my protocol, and refuse drugs.
Got it.
And they didn't take the time to understand that my message was, talk to your neurologist, decide whatever you want to decide about the drugs, but you must address diet quality, smoking, meditation, and movement. This should be part of everyone's self-care plan. And once they began to realize that I'm not telling them to refuse drugs. Yeah, right. I'm telling them, you meet with your neurologist and you decide clinically what is right for you. But everyone will do much better if we deal with diet, deal with smoking, deal with meditation, and move. And it's sort of like they finally read my book. Mm-hmm. But I think we have to be honest with ourselves. All of us, we reject information that doesn't fit into our understanding of the world. Mm-hmm. We reject it over and over again until it's overwhelming that we'll finally admit, like, okay, my previous understanding of the world was wrong. You know, 2 and 2, that doesn't really equal 4. It does equal 5 now that I see the world in a new way. None of us will accept new information very readily.
And I do think that, you know, your approach, especially, you know, the nature of the, you know, multimodal interventions, trying to get multiple things to work together to affect chronic disease, that does seem to be, you know, the new template that's going to be necessary to address all types of chronic disease, and is going to really need to be a new way of structuring medicine.
That is a way, the only way we can create health. When I first started doing my research, I got called in to multiple meetings and was told that I had to pick just one of the interventions, study one molecular pathway at a time. And I kept saying, no, we have to study everything. And fortunately, the Institutional Review Board had seen me become profoundly disabled, saw me remarkably, you know, come back to health. And I think had I not been part of the IRB, I would have never gotten approval of this. Mm. The study question that my first study question, Craig, was, could other people do my protocol? Mm. Yes or no? And if they did, what was the effect size? Because remember, we're asking people who had profound disability, severe fatigue, to radically change their diet. We had many, many things we're asking them to do, because we and take a bunch of supplements. So because we had written out the protocol of what I had done, and so we're trying to see, could anyone else do it? And once we made it clear that we weren't trying to change the disease course, we're just trying to see, could people do it, and was it safe? Did we hurt anyone? And then what was the effect size to these other folks? No one expected, when you have only 20 people in the study, to have an effect size of any significance. You just want to trend in the right direction.
Sure.
As a matter of fact, people lost weight so rapidly, so consistently, I'm having to file reports back to the IRB every 3 months with everyone's weight, how things were, what we were seeing, and that we were reporting the weight changes back to the person's personal physicians. And then in terms of the reduction in fatigue and the improvement in quality of life, the p-value for those changes, and by the way, the changes were dramatic. So reduction in fatigue was 2.38 on a scale of 1 to 7. And the clinically significant difference is 0.45.
Wow.
The improvement in quality of life was 16 points, and the clinical difference is 5. So these are very large favorable changes clinically in these two groups. And the p-value was less than 0.0005.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
This is a, this
unbelievable.
This is where you get it. You can see it across the room. You don't need the statistician to tell you whether it's
right. You know, and when I'm going around the university and around the world showing the videos of what we could see, and again, I make it very clear, not everyone experienced these kinds of improvements. Mm-hmm. But in progressive MS, you know, as I said, 10 to 20% worsening every year is what you expect. We have these dramatic improvements in walking. One lady, it took her 127 seconds to walk 8 feet, turn around, sit back down in her chair. At the end of the year, she was down to 43 seconds. She still needed her walker.
That's nice.
But you know, you can see, anybody can see a difference between something that takes 127 seconds and comes down to 43 seconds.
Absolutely.
And when you talk about patients that don't improve, I think, you know, one of the hardest things I find in practicing lifestyle medicine is when patients are able to do, let's say, 80% of the change, but you want to have a dialogue with them about the potential benefit if they can get to 100% and to see what that does. I'm just curious, you know, your experience about kind of getting to the tipping point and how you convince patients to, you know, get to that.
To make these changes?
Yeah.
You know, I learned this from my veterans. And I learned this working with a therapeutic lifestyle clinic, that groups are incredibly powerful for making behavior change. Mm. That, you know, I'm pretty good one-on-one with patients, but you put people in a group of 10 to 15 people, and you bring, have them meet month after month, and so they get to know each other over 6 months to a year. That group dynamic is incredibly powerful. And as people in the group experience success, they celebrate. As they experience challenges, they ask for help from one another. And I might offer the same suggestion, but it lands very differently if they're hearing it from another veteran who explains how they dealt with a spouse who was not supportive, or how they dealt with extended family members who were less than supportive. That group dynamic is very powerful. Other things that are incredibly important is to have the conversation with the vet. What do they want their health for? And is there someone or something that they care so much that they would run into a green room? And if there is nothing they want their health for, if they have no one for whom they would run into a burning building, that person will not be successful. Mm. And so that individual, we refer to mental health services until they have clarity on those two issues. And then my advice is that they work with the mental health professional, and when they are ready, they can come back to the group. So you get to be in my group by invitation and by commitment that you're willing to do this 100% for 100 days. And if it's not the right time because your family is having a crisis because your spouse is dealing with breast cancer, then this is not the time to be working with me. But come back when it is the right time. So it's voluntary. You come when you're ready to do the work. And we may have you work with mental health counseling to understand your mission, your purpose, and why you want to do the work. I never argue with people. Mm-hmm. They're ready to do the work. They're ready to be part of the group. They're ready for their hero's journey. And we celebrate and struggle together. And if it's not the right time, that's okay. You can go work with mental health and then come back when it is the right time.
That's great. I'm really curious, Dr. Walls, about what the protocol specifically is. We've talked about, it's a diet approach and meditation and e-stim, but what specifically is going on with, what is happening in the diet that separates it from keto or from a swank diet?
So, this is very interesting. So people who have a clinical reason to be on a ketogenic diet, we could still have them be on a ketogenic diet, but I teach them how to do it in a way that is nutrient dense, that makes sure that they're less likely to have serious mineral deficiencies, vitamin deficiencies. A lot of keto diets are based on dairy and eggs and will still be very, very inflammatory, and they'll be relatively low in vitamin C, for example. We have people who need to be on a low saturated fat diet because they do have serious dyslipidemia. Maybe they have diabetes and had heart disease, and they can still be on a low saturated fat diet, but we teach them how to do that in a way that is nutrient dense. So I understand the clinical needs. Then we will tailor the dietary plan to meet that clinical need. In the big picture, I'm removing gluten, so gluten-containing grains, wheat, rye, barley. We're removing dairy proteins and also remove eggs. Those are the three most common inflammation-producing foods. Then we ramp up the vegetables in a very specific way. We teach meditation. We talk about movement strategies. We talk about electrostimulation of muscles, and then we support that journey. This is not a diet. This is a way of living and being, and how you approach life.
Is the meditation a specific type of meditation? Like you were saying before earlier, how you try to get people into a group so they have the support with one another. Well, is it a group type of meditation or meditation on your own?
So we talk about meditative practices. So in my veteran community, there'll be a wide spectrum of beliefs and spiritual practices. Many of our veterans find that spiritual meditative practice, hunting, fishing, being out in their gardens, Some will do it with Epsom salts baths. Some will do it with free writing about their time in military service. Others will do transcendental meditation, guided meditation, 4-7-8 breath work.
Is the overall goal to lower the stress response?
Yes. The overall goal is to teach the veteran that they have at their fingertip many different tools to do that.
Mm-hmm. Since you've been working with veterans in MS, do you see a large percentage of those with, per se, PTSD developing MS?
You know,
and that connection between stress?
I see when I look at patients with autoimmune issues, whether it's MS or inflammatory bowel disease, rheumatoid arthritis, and I'm working through the timeline of their health events, their life events, and when maybe had onset of symptoms or major worsening of symptoms, a flare of psychological stress is a very, very common thing. Another very common thing is adverse childhood experiences. In the veteran world, toxin exposures occur more commonly than in the non-veteran world. And concussions will occur more commonly as well.
Absolutely. Shell shock and everything.
Yeah.
Why is it that stress makes it worse for MS?
Well, stress makes it worse for MS and for autoimmunity. And I'll also tell you, it makes it worse for insulin resistance, diabetes as well as anxiety and depression. When you have the elevated stress that is relentless, so you don't have any periods of relaxation, with that chronic elevated stress, you alter the pituitary adrenal response you have insulin resistance, you have elevated glucose, you have pro-inflammatory cytokines, you have microglia activation, you have worsening central obesity, tend to have suppressed sex hormones, and you tend to have disordered thyroid hormones as well. So it sets up a cascade of poor metabolism, excessive inappropriate inflammation, which, you know, depending on your chronic health problems, that's going to lead to more anxiety, more depression, more irritability. It will lead toward earlier development of autoantibodies and progression of your autoimmune processes, which will lead to autoimmune diagnosis. And if you don't get to the root cause, Craig, what will happen is you will get one autoimmune diagnosis, and then every decade you'll begin to get another, and then another, and then another.
What are some of these root causes? So stress could be one of them, especially if you have autoimmunity, but what else could be causing?
So there's going to be many. I think adverse childhood experiences are part of it. I think the epigenetic changes that were experienced by your parents, your grandparents, your great-grandparents, and now your great-great-grandparents. We know epigenetic changes get passed on four generations. So you can think about the severe psychological stress that our ancestral mothers and fathers experienced from their hardships, financial, fiscal, emotional, that never got resolved, got passed on epigenetically. And so that's part of all of this. The stress of the birth experience and the prenatal, perinatal time period will increase the responsiveness of the excessiveness of the cortisol response to stress, changes in the microbiome in terms of antibiotic exposure early, sugar processed food exposure early, particularly things that happen before the age of 3 change the mix of the microbiome in my gut. And again, the research continues to explode that the mix of microbes in my gut have a huge impact on the set point for the inflammation markers in the inflammatory cytokines in my bloodstream and the level of inflammation in the expressed by the microglia in my brain. The balance of my sex hormones, thyroid hormones, and cortisol will also influence the risk of autoimmunity. The air and water quality, food quality in terms of toxin exposures, if I'm a smoker, markedly increases my risk of autoimmunity. If I have air pollution that I'm exposed to, that appears to increase my risk of autoimmunity. If my water is contaminated with lead or mercury, that will increase my risk. So we am I sedentary? Do I have central obesity as a child? What is my vitamin D level? Am I telling myself that I'm a loser? I'm a failure all of this time. Do I have social connections? Am I struggling with chronic shame? All of these factors either create a more nurturing, healing environment for my cells or a more dysfunctional environment for my cells.
So is the Walls protocol just creating a environment that is conducive for healing?
Yes. It, you know, I really focused on the cellular level, and I focused on the microenvironment. You know, when I was so severely criticized, you know, it was so funny early on in 2008, 2009, people are giving me a hard time, like, Terry, you treat everybody the same way. This is just not right. You should have a different treatment for diabetes, a different treatment for high blood pressure, a different treatment for anxiety. And I'd say, like, well, you know, I think we all have mitochondria. We all have cell membranes. I'm just trying to help the environment for those mitochondria and for those cell membranes. And then I'm watching my patients carefully to be sure that they're not over-medicated. That's all I'm doing. And that still is really all that I'm doing. I'm looking at how to create the best cellular microenvironment by helping patients nudge their self-care routines into steadily more nurturing, healthier choices. We spend a lot of time discussing how to create better health and a better self-care routine, step by step.
Well, it's a little bit of a different paradigm. It's not being disease-specific, but saying that there are optimal practices to just encourage overall health that can apply to 90% plus of the population.
Absolutely.
And yet that's such a, you know, that's not a common paradigm in medicine.
It is radical. And the other thing that I focus on is, what is your self-care routine and how can we keep nudging it so you're doing a more effective job of caring for yourself? One of the things that my vets taught me again is taking the time to discuss the hero's journey. And, you know, discussing the great myths that inspire us so much. Part of that is there's a lot at stake. You had no idea if the hero was going to make it, if they're going to die trying. But you were really impressed with the fact that they didn't give up and they just kept at it. And so relate that to their current struggles that, yep, we don't know if you're going to succeed or not. But you could choose to be inspiring to your family and to your children and your grandchildren by staying in the game and keeping at it. And when you do that in a group, when you have those conversations in a group and people are talking about their struggle and their fears, and like, oh my God, this is so hard, and you do it in a group, that's behavior change on steroids. Those people will stay at it and keep making favorable incremental changes and begin to experience improvement. And then you keep bringing in new people into the group. So now you have some seniors, and now I get to coach the other new person. It is such a wonderful thing to see. I had no idea that I thought I was good at it. But let me tell you, when you put people in a group and you let people mentor newer folks, change is so much more effective in that environment.
That's a great concept. It kind of takes the idea similar to Alcoholics Anonymous or those other supportive groups. And when you have a mentor like that, it's definitely going to keep you on track, make you more resilient.
Mentor, you have a sponsor. Then when you get to be the mentor and the sponsor, people are so energized and they do amazing things. You know, just like these vets would do amazing things for each other in times of war. And when they realize that now, they are in their very exciting hero's journey, and they're helping other vets in their hero's journey. I learned so much from my vets. They taught me how to do this.
Seeing other people having your issues definitely helps your progression. I could see how having a mentor or being support for someone could help someone with their fatigue, even without starting the protocol.
Yeah, you know, think of going through medical school. It's sort of like, you know, see one, do one, teach one, and then you really understand the process. And so going through this in a group, being supportive, becoming a mentor, a sponsor for someone, and you still want to have me in the group helping shepherd the group to keep them headed all in the right direction. But oh my goodness, this is, it's inspiring. It is like such a fun way to practice medicine.
I bet. I want to know a little bit more about the resilience factors that you have to make more people more resilient to MS and autoimmunity, what they can do. Like, what are some ways that people with MS can, once they've already started the protocol, for example, help with remyelination or reduce their cytokines?
So now there's two different questions we're asking here. The resilience factors that I talk about are the emotional resilience factors that allow you to be willing to do the work, because it is very uncomfortable to give up the sugar, tobacco, alcohol, to give up these addictive compounds. That's very uncomfortable. You're going to go through withdrawal, craving. And so for people to have peer support, at least one other adult or living being for whom they are deeply connected for that social connection, a religious or spiritual belief, the internal hero's journey, all of that adds immensely to the resilience to be capable of doing the work. So that's one thing. Now, for the other resilience factors, we need to stop doing the damage cellularly. So you got to get rid of the toxins. You want to be sure you have a nutrient-dense diet. You have all of the components, and you want to have a healthy microbiome. And you want to rebalance your hormonal parts, and that comes down to enough cholesterol, enough minerals, stress reduction, strength training. Those are the key components.
Now, strength training over cardiovascular, why that?
You'll get a lot more growth factor. You'll get better response to your sex hormones with strength training. If the person's capable of high-intensity interval training, that is also a strategy. Strength training is preferable, but high-intensity interval training is another option.
Well, strength training does sound like it would be a little bit easier for someone who has more fatigue, because HIIT, you have to have the endurance for it.
Right. They can't do HIIT. And in my population, they may start out with doing just 1 minute of strength training. They may be that weak. And you have to be very sensitive to can they do their workout and still function the rest of the day? And can they function the next day? So the key principle here is workout that gives mild to moderate stress to the system with enough recovery period so for your cells to go ahead and repair all the damage from the exercise before you exercise again.
So we're talking about hormesis here.
We're talking about hormesis.
A little bit of stress.
And that's the principle for all exercises. You have a little bit of stress, enough time to repair the damage, build stronger muscles, and then you have a little bit of stress again. And in people with chronic disease and autoimmune disease, the most common problem is we train them too hard, or they accidentally train too hard. They don't have a long enough period to recover.
That makes sense. Yeah, they're overtraining. Even if it's something that seems like the standard for someone who's healthy.
Right.
They're overtraining. Yeah.
They can easily be overtrained. So sometimes, my people work out a minute. Sometimes they work out 3 minutes. Sometimes they work out 5 minutes. My vets could sometimes start out with a half hour workout. So you have to have a very careful discussion and evaluation to know what is a reasonable starting point to try, then assess how they responded to the first workout.
With working out, do you do E-stim around the same time?
If someone's going to do E-stim, they do E-stim during the workout.
because I've seen that in a lot of physical therapy practices, but I wondered if that still applied.
You do ESTIM during the workout. You do a volitional contraction of the muscles while it's being electrically contracted, because you want to reinforce the connection between the brain and the muscle.
Terry, I have a question about toxins. In your view, what are the toxins that are, you know, contributing the most to autoimmunity?
It depends on where the person is living. Mm-hmm. So they may have contamination of lead, mercury in the environment because of local releases. Mm-hmm. The person may have tobacco use. They may have had a personal exposure to heavy metals because of their art history or soldering or welding or a lot of mercury in their mouth. Because of the plastics in emulsifiers, in processed foods, in food packaging, you may have a fair amount of hormonal disruptions. So there may be some local factors, and then you have to think about individual factors. A lot of my folks in the military had told me that they had 30 vaccinations mm-hmm. on the day that they were deployed. A lot of them went into theater and then had burn pits mm-hmm. that they were bivouacked next to, and said that they were basically downwind of the burn pits and had daily exposure. And again, my patients have told me that their family was crop dusted routinely because of the crop dusting patterns, or that they were helping their dad with their crop dusting, asking people what their thoughts are, what do they think their exposures were, and then having, you know, a deeper query about various toxins.
And as you're talking about really a paradigm change in how, you know, medicine should be practiced, I feel like this whole area of toxins is kind of one of the areas where there's the most controversy, or you get kind of the biggest immediate negative response within the conventional medicine world. You know, do you have any thoughts on why this whole area creates as much controversy as it does?
Well, life is a whole lot easier because of the chemical revolution that has substituted chemistry for human labor, which has made life easier for how we manufacture stuff, how we grow things. And so we know that we're exposed to more chemicals. It's uncomfortable to think about, okay, if you give all that up, it's going to be very expensive to live organically. And so people feel like, okay, this is a elitist move.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I make the observation in my lifestyle clinic, the people I saw were living on food stamps in small towns in Iowa, Missouri, Illinois. They weren't going to Whole Foods. They weren't eating organic food. They were just doing the best that they could with their limited financial resources. And so they might still be eating conventional food. And they were still living in their community that was maybe did not have the cleanest water. But teaching my folks how to eat and meditate and move their bodies, their blood pressure still improved. Their blood sugar still improved. We still were able to reduce and simplify their meds. Now, true, if they had been able to go organic, I think they would have improved more rapidly. That's true, but we work very carefully to respect everyone's financial limits and means. And certainly not everyone went paleo, because many of my folks, or at least some of them, were still vegetarian or vegan for their spiritual beliefs, or they couldn't afford meat because they were living on food stamps.
You say that some people are vegetarian or vegan. For the diet, I know you talked in your book a lot about organ meats. Can they also supplement with organ meat extracts instead?
Sure. So we have people can do organ meat capsules. We teach them how to make liver that's actually quite delicious. As a matter of fact, we had that last night. One of our family favorite meals, baked chicken liver. It's quite delicious. But I also have people who are vegetarian or vegan for their spiritual beliefs. We're not going to ask them to drop their spiritual beliefs. I'll assess their B12 and we'll address that. We'll assess their omega-3, omega-6 fatty acids. And so I may have to supplement them if there's some nutritional imbalances. But I'm not going to ask people to go against their spiritual belief.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, that creates that, you know, in terms of those personal resilience factors, you would create dissonance, and that's just not going to work for them.
Absolutely, yeah. You don't want someone to be thrown off the protocol just because of a minor thing like that.
Correct. And that's why I'm very careful to say that, yes, you can do this in a ketogenic way. You could also do it in a low saturated fat way. Or you could do it in a vegan way or a paleo way. The key point is to design a diet that's maximally nutrient dense, that will fix your mitochondria and fix your cell membranes.
In terms of cell membranes, what's the best thing that people can do?
Well, get rid of the sugar. So that's going to be really important. We want to have the omega-3, omega-6 fatty acid ratio, ideally 4:1. We'll add fish oil. And again, the amount that I add that depends in part, are you a low saturated fat person or not? And if we can do it, I like to add phosphatidylcholine. That can be very helpful as well. That will depend in part on the person's financial resources, whether or not I can add the phosphatidylcholine.
Do you see any adverse reactions to phosphatidylcholine in your patients with autoimmunity?
I think in all the years I've had one person report an adverse problem that they developed a skin rash.
Okay. So I don't mean necessarily allergic reaction. A lot of the clients that I've worked with, as well as myself, because I have this issue with cholinergics, and it seems to drive up my autoimmunity. As well as theirs. So they get this worsening reaction.
For any supplement, I want people to start supplements one at a time. And if when you start the supplement, you perceive there is a problem, then you stop that. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure why I've had less problem than you've had. Perhaps I've just been extraordinarily fortunate that way.
I was just curious about if there's a mechanism I've missed.
Well, apparently I've missed it too.
All right, great. How can people learn more information where they can get your book and see this documentary?
Oh, yeah. So if you go to terrywalls.com, Terry Walls, WAHLS.com, you can see my website. And if you add /diet, you get a one-page summary of the Walls diet. Again, I want to remind everyone that diet is just the beginning to a whole new way of thinking about life. For the documentary, I would go to defyingallodds.com, and there'll be links there for where you can purchase access to that. You know,
and if they want to contact you?
So we have ways of contacting us on the website, terrywalls.com. We have many types of programs to help support people in this healing journey. We intermittently do 5-day challenges to help people get started. Our next one's going to be starting in early January, and that can be really quite transformative. People can access that anywhere in the globe. And you can learn more about that at terrywalls.com/5-day.
Is the research also on your website or
Pubmed?
Where can people read?
Yeah, so to get the research is very exciting. If you go to terrywalls.com/research-papers,
okay,
you can get access to all of the research that we've done. You can also see some of those really amazing video changes that are just so inspiring to see the level of change.
And if a practitioner wants to get involved and learn more, or if a patient wants to find a practitioner that's practicing this protocol and learn more, where can they do that?
We do have practitioners. If you look on terrywalls.com on the resource pages, there is a link, and you can search according to geography. You can also search according towards specialty and the particular type of concern. And we do train practitioners. So we have a certification program that's appropriate for physicians, health coaches, chiropractors, nutrition professionals, movement professionals, mental health professionals. We have new terms starting every quarter, and people are able to do that virtually. I think we have 25 or 29 different countries represented. It's virtual, online modules you can take at your own pace, plus a combination of sessions you have with me leading case discussions. And then once you get certified, you can be part of a monthly Zoom meeting with me where we go through cases, answer questions, and we'll have a guest lecturer or speaker to give a presentation. That's really a phenomenal, phenomenal resource.
That sounds like an amazing resource. That is phenomenal. Thank you so much for being on the show today. It was great having you.
Thank you, Terry.
Well, thank you. I love getting this information out.
Dr. Tanio is the only doctor certified in the WALS protocol in Florida. So if you're in Florida and want to learn more information, you can always go to Resilier Health. Thanks, guys, for listening. And to learn more information about her protocol, I've written up a breakdown of her latest book and current research, which can be found on ResilierHealth.com or MyBioHack.com. Thanks, guys, for listening, and I'll catch you in the next episode.